Hi, I'm Sam, an alcoholic.
Hi, Sam.
Member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's the rest of it. There we go. I'm also the world's oldest living drug addict. I smoked a lot of non-habit-forming marijuana that I was addicted to. Nowadays, mostly what we get in here is a bunch of people that their drinking consisted of drinking while they were driving around looking for drugs. Yeah? Okay. There's pure alcoholics around, too. Of course, they're dying out. But my point is, there's room for everybody that comes in here. I've heard it said that the dope fiends are going to corrupt Alcoholics Anonymous. People who can't get across the street without walk, don't walk signs are not going to corrupt AA. Not that any doper ever paid any attention to those damn things. I don't know how you people drank, but I did a lot of it. I didn't mess around with it. I tried everything. I don't identify with people who specialize. Take it all. It might work. I've been addicted to Alka-Seltzer, Bromo-Seltzer, Midol tablets, anything. If it works on an empty stomach, what the hell? I need to ask a question, too. Are there any lower companions here today? Thank you. I don't know anything about falling from a high place. I just started at the bottom and laid there. I didn't go any place. I come from a family of alcoholics, and when I was a kid, I was taught a lot of wonderful things by my Aunt Bessie. She was drunk all the time. She used to tell me bedtime stories. She only had two. She said, "Do you want to hear about the time your Uncle Louie was a bootlegger or when I was a whore in Peoria?" And Bessie would give me a quarter if I would say fuck in the grocery store and embarrass my mother. I got a dollar if I said it in church. So, oh, yeah. My Aunt Bessie, in one of her more maudlin moments, told me the secret of life. And I thought, I better remember this because it seemed to be important to her. She said, "What happens is you fall out of the womb and you crawl across hostile territory towards a grave, and that's it." So my mother sentenced me to 8 years in a Catholic school. For the cure, I majored in guilt, which was their big thing over there at that time, and I'm not sure that much has changed since then. It's been 100 years ago. I'm old, if you haven't figured that out, too. I was lucky enough to come in here at an early age and sober up, and I also learned from the very beginning I don't need to mess around with any drugs, too. First, I did. I went to meetings where they didn't mention marijuana, so I didn't mention it. Nobody mentioned heroin. some of the other things that I liked. What I really liked was amphetamines. Well, I bullshitted myself that they enhanced my intelligence. And of course, all they did was speed up my mouth. So I had an amphetamine mouth and a Demerol brain, and get you in a lot of trouble. I did my time in the Catholic school and got out, and I had remained in the family business, which was stealing, and I got into a lot of trouble. The nuns kept me out of jail, but when I got out of there, I went straight to a reform school, where the discipline was pretty much the same, and I didn't feel that much out of place there. While I was there, I went through puberty in about 20 minutes, and I got out of there, and I was nothing but a horny little kid loose on the streets. And all I had was a hard-on and a bad attitude. No place to put either one. So I stood on street corners waiting for somebody to come along and molest me. Years later, I used to sit around therapy sessions. I was molested as a child. The simple truth of that is I didn't tell all of it. I just told part of it. And all it happened to be was the paper boy, and he'd copped a feel. And he'd given me 50 cents. And what I didn't tell people was that I liked it, and I was out there the very next Saturday looking for him. So I was a trick and didn't know it. When I was 16 years old, I fell in love with... I was in heat. I wasn't in love. I didn't know what love was. But we got married because she was pregnant, and I was a father before I was 17. And I mean, I didn't know how it happened. I didn't know what the hell was going on. And about that same time, I got arrested, and I was put in the penitentiary that time. I had 9 felony counts against me, and I was lucky enough to have 2 uncles in there who protected me. Otherwise, I had to change my name to Tammy. And so I got out of there, but while I was did my 19 months in there, the sweet young thing had wandered off and had divorced me and married a nice guy and moved to Pittsburgh, and that was the end of that romance. And I began to freelance all over the place. I never particularly cared what went on. I just went for it, and I started using drugs and booze. Up to that time, I hadn't done anything. I drank very, very little, taken very few drugs. But by the age of 20, when I got out of the penitentiary, I went for it. By the time I was 22, 23 years old, I was hooked on everything I had tried and was looking for more and praying that the pharmaceutical companies would come out with something that would keep me out of trouble. What I didn't know was that I was the problem, because I never knew when to stop. I used to explain to my sponsor that I was of an addictive nature. He said, "No, you're not. You're a pig." What I didn't know was he had bullshit filters in his ears. He could translate things that I had to say into the truth. I ran into a mathematical genius that I had gone to school with, and he figured out how to fill out income tax forms and get money back, even though I did not work where he said I worked. We got $1,200, cashed the check and split it, and the next year we did it again, and 2 weeks after the check arrived, the police arrived. So I'm in trouble again. And I hope that's the laughter of identification. Uh, anyway, I'd used my father's name, so they arrested my father for it. My father was drunk all the time. He thought he had done it. He went into court and pled guilty, and they put him away. While he was in the federal penitentiary at Terre Haute, Indiana, he discovered Alcoholics Anonymous, and the old son of a bitch sobered up and never took a drink the rest of his life. Yeah, he never knew I 12-stepped him. That could have been the first intervention in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I think of that far back, yeah, it probably was. Anyway. The day after I got off parole, I moved to a town where I had heard about, and I'd been there a couple of times, and they sold marijuana in the liquor stores. Now, there's a town for you. Yeah, Covington, Kentucky. Yeah, the big city. I hung out with a lot of Italians that I thought were gangsters, and they weren't. They were just Italians. And because I like gangsters. Those are my heroes. The hell with that George Washington, Abe Lincoln crap. I didn't have anything to do with that. George Washington snitched on himself. What the hell is that? No thanks. So I did hang out in some pretty low-life bars. Because I knew enough to just stay at the bottom. I'm a bottom feeder type person, and I hung out in some very low-life bars. And I was a witness to a killing, and I knew I was going to be subpoenaed, and I knew I'd better get the hell out of there and change my name and do all the usual things that I had done before. And I reeled in my umbilical cord and went home to Mama. Mama had been to Al-Anon. Oh, yeah. I know there's Al-Anons here. I can feel you releasing me. You ever been released by a whole group of Al-Anons? Ooh, don't look in the mirror, no reflection. They can do a good job on you. Anyway, my mother got me up against the wall and released me. I said that I could stay there for a few days and then I had to get the hell out because I was loaded and I was going to stay loaded, and she knew it. And of course, who, me? Well, I was there. My youngest brother came running from the police and others. And one morning he and I were puking together. He said, if our luck holds out, we'll be dead by noon. And that's how far it had gone. And pretty soon we got some wine to stay down, and then it went the other way. He said, as soon as we get off of this one, let's really go on one. And that's the way it always was. I could turn real easy with that booze in me. A couple of days later, I woke up in a wrecked car in a field full of other wrecked cars in a junkyard. And if you're paranoid, that's a little crazy. You panic, and I did. My brother woke me up. He said, wake up, I think we've been thrown away. Well, for a few seconds, I believed him. I thought, uh-oh, they've caught on. So I moved to Venice, California, where I was to live for the next 30 years of my life. And I knew enough to start at the bottom again. I stayed right there. I walked into a bar, and I said, where is the worst place in town to live? A guy said, there's an apartment building up the street that I don't even go in the daytime. Okay, that's where I went. I lived next door to a girl who was a manic, depressive, suicidal, schizophrenic, who carried 3 suicide notes and a razor blade for emergencies. She would come home every night from work, brush her teeth, turn on the gas, and go to bed. I liked the way she lied. That was the important thing there. What I learned from her, I liked the way she lied about things and put the blame every place else. The fastest gun in the West. It's your fault. And so I lived there for 2 years. And at the end of that time, or close to the end of that time, I called my father at Christmas time, which was the only time he would accept a collect call from me. And he said, "Well, what did you get for Christmas, smartass?" And I told him I got a 500-pound benzedrine tablet and 2 gallons of wine. That's what I had fantasized about. Think about one of them big benzedrine tablets and get at it with an ice pick and rock it to the moon. He suggested that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "What for?" He said, "Because you're dying and you better do something about it." And I said, "I'm too young." He said, "No, you're not." For some reason or other, I paid attention to him. And it took me 2 days to quit everything because I was taking a lot of things. And he told me, he said, "Before you go over there, don't you smoke any marijuana because you're not going to hear anything." I didn't know marijuana affected my hearing that much. I smoked it for other reasons. Anyway. It took me 2 days to quit everything, and I got on a bus and went into Los Angeles looking for Alcoholics Anonymous. There wasn't any in Venice at that time. And I was so screwed up that I'm in and out of phone booths trying to call, and I would hang up, and I couldn't do it, and I couldn't talk, I couldn't say anything. And it took me till almost 10 o'clock that night to get to a meeting. About 10 minutes of 10, and I walked in, and there was a lady sharing, and she said that she'd wet her pants twice, and she came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, "Oh, wait till they find out what I've done." I didn't think anything about wetting your pants. What the hell's that got to do with anything? Christ, the bars I drank in, one of them's still around back where I live, and had a sign up that says, "Men's room." You open the door, you're in the parking lot. High-class place. If it's Saturday night, the bouncer stops you at the door and asks if you've got a gun. If you don't have one, he gives you one. That kind of a place. Anyway, I went to a meeting the next night, and somebody gave me a book, which I promptly threw away. I don't need this thing. Because they kept reading chapter 5 at the meetings, and I kept hearing demands rigorous honesty, and I thought, I ain't going to make it. So I stayed clean and sober for 10 days, and because nobody had mentioned marijuana and heroin and other things, I didn't mention it either. So I smoked a joint, and I got thirsty, so I drank, and I got drowsy, so I took some pills. A natural progression, for me anyway. But while I was loaded, I remembered that I had heard somebody say at a meeting something about a lower companion. And I knew what I was, and I thought, okay, let's give it one more try. And so I have been sober since that day, which January the 11th, 1957. Abe Lincoln was president then, I think. long time ago. I cleaned up one more time, went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked a guy, where the hell is a lower companion meeting? He says, "I have just the group for you over in the corner of Pico and Alvarado. There's a group called the End of the Line." I thought, yeah, I like the name already. I said, "Let's go." So he took me over there and left me there. Did say he'd come back and pick me up after the meeting. Anyway, I walked into that place and I disappeared. I felt at home from the very beginning because... They pounded the gavel down at the beginning of the meeting. The guy says, "There ain't no traditions here. It's every man for himself." All right. They didn't bother with any of the reading. He asked for announcements. The guy stood up and said that he was sinking into a depression. He was going to kill himself and wouldn't be at the meeting next week. Wanted to say goodbye to all of his friends. Chairman says, "Go ahead and do it, you son of a bitch. Nobody likes you anyway." I was home. Yeah. I fell in love with that group. About 10 minutes into the meeting, through the side door came three dykes. Yeah. Well, that was rare in those days. I mean, for somebody to be upfront about that sort of thing. But here, at the end of the line group, nobody thought much about it. As they came through the door, the drunken one stumbled and fell and dropped her purse, and out fell a gun, a bottle, and a dildo. Standard equipment for a dyke's purse, for all I know. Anyway, the two sober ones got to fighting over the contents of the purse. The chairman kicked him out. They left the drinking one there, and she sobered up, and she never took a drink the rest of her life. And from the beginning, she was very upfront about things. She said, "Hi, I'm Aggie the Dyke." Well, we kind of figured that. Big Harley motor tattooed on her right arm, flat top haircut. You didn't do that sort of thing in those days. But by God, Aggie did. She was one of the kindest human beings I've ever met in my life. And it was one of the wonderful relationships that I've been able to have since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally found people that I could communicate with, could communicate with me, and we loved each other. And by God, it was almost from the very beginning, from that end of the line group, that's what I consider my beginning, I felt at home. I saw a guy there that I used to drink with, so I asked him to be my sponsor. He had disappeared. He'd been sober 6 months. I thought, where had George gone? Well, George had gone to AA. I thought he'd gone to jail, the usual. And I asked him to be my sponsor, but he had a rather liberal program, which was too liberal for me, so a couple of weeks later, we were on our way to a meeting, that same meeting, the end of the line group, and we stopped to get something to eat, and George ordered a ham sandwich and a bottle of beer. I said, "George, I think that's a no-no." He said to me, "Beer is a beverage, punk." Okay. I took my ham sandwich and left, and George got another drunk driving charge on the way home, and pretty soon he got another one. He ended up doing a lot of time in jail, and he ended up about 6 years after that being shot and killed by a bus driver in Santa Monica. Now, you really got to antagonize a bus driver to get shot through the heart. Usually, they just kick your ass off the bus or call the cops. But no. Shot him right through the heart. So much for beer as a beverage, punk. $3,000 drinks on the market, you got to drink that crap. No, thanks. I'm not with these near beer types. Too near to beer. I have what I like to think of as a liberal program, but I got to draw the line someplace with some things. Now, I don't hang out with, well, it's obvious I don't hang out with groups that have dress codes. Have all those rules. That dumbass over there anyway, well, they used to put down fags all the time. Yeah, goddamn queers hanging around our meeting. Yeah. Oh, he said that crap, and I remembered that he used to play piano in a gay bar in San Francisco. Oh, but we don't talk about that. There is room for everybody in here. Now, I've had to learn that lesson over and over because I sobered up in Venice, and so we decided to start an AA group there, some of us who lived there. And we had a group drunk, and I think everybody should have a group drunk. And the guy's name was Brian Norton. All he knew was keep coming back. He didn't know anything else. He was drunk at every meeting. And after a while, I got on my high horse and thought, well, it's time to clean up this group. My sponsor says to me, by this time, of course, I had to have another sponsor who cut through all the bullshit, as I've said. And he explained to me that Brian had as much right as anybody else to be in there. And he said, I got to tell you what the rules are around here. If he's loud, he goes. If he's quiet, he stays. The only requirement for membership here is breathing. All right, pretty open group. I said, well, would you consider rewriting chapter 5? Because I don't like it. And yeah. So we rewrote the damn thing and set it to music. And Central Office was scared to death of us. They didn't know what we were going to do next. We rewrote everything. And all the cliches you got up around here, you know, live and let live. We wrote it to mind your own goddamn business. Understand that. Instead of we care, it was we give a fuck. Now, when I was about 5 or 6 years sober, I fell into a line of work that I'm still in today. And within a couple of years, I made myself a lot of money. And I got very arrogant. And I mean to tell you, George Orwell's Animal Farm says it pretty well about me. There's a guy in there that gets up in front of the whole group and he says, we are all equal here. However, I am more equal than you. And that's what I had become. Fortunately, I had the sponsor with the bullshit filters in his ears. And we'd get into large arguments and I'd yell at him, you old wet-brained son of a bitch, let me alone. He would say to me, did you hear that noise? I'd say, what noise? He'd say, I heard your mind close. Yeah. Well, with as much money as I was making, it was time to flaunt it. So, got to show the newcomer something. I pulled the gangster thing. I walked into the Cadillac agency there on Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills and bought a Cadillac convertible, and I paid cash. I peeled that money off just like this. The guy just looking at me like, oh, dope dealer, huh? Anyway, I drove the Cadillac convertible back to the Venice meeting, and I parked it in front of the door, where you had to go over it, under it, or through it to get into the meeting. And I walked inside, and there's my sponsor talking to a newcomer, and the newcomer says, what kind of a car did Sam get? My sponsor says, he got a green one. I said, it's a Cadillac convertible, you old fool. He said, let me tell you something, Bodine. He said, there's two kinds of cars, those that run and those that don't run. Have you got that? So he cut through the bullshit again and saved my life. And so I had to get rid of some of that stuff. I mean, he's right. There's only two kinds of cars. Simple as that. And so I learned so much from him, and I've learned so much from other people. There's an art to listening. And for years, what mine consisted of was waiting for you to shut up so I could say something important. No. Had to learn how to listen. And so I paid attention to some of the wonderful people that I've met here. A guy named Larry Blake was a very important person in my life. I followed him around. He was a tough old bird, but boy, he didn't put up with any crap. I was sober about a year, and I was going to a meeting up on the edge of Hollywood, and speaker got up, and he's about 10 minutes into his talk, and he said, you know, I got to be honest with you. He said, when it gets tough, I take a drink. And I thought, what the hell am I at tonight? What is this shit? Blake was in the front row. He said, you son of a bitch. Right up on the stage, grabbed this guy literally around the throat, took him over to the side door, and we hear bang, slammed the door. Blake comes back. Good evening, my name is Larry Blake. I'm an alcoholic, your speaker for this evening. And launched right into it like nothing had ever happened. My hero, one of my heroes. And there have been plenty of others, too, along the way that have stood up for what they believed and showed me the way to go, truth and honesty, when I was not into that at all. And it took some practice with that, too. And it still comes and goes on some days. And I think, no, you better... So I have a coffee commitment at the moment. I had to hit a newcomer in the head to get it, but I got the goddamn thing. I tried to bribe him with a year of sobriety. That stuff still runs through my mind. I still think like that. I still think very bizarrely about a lot of things. And it's just the way it is. In the business that I'm in, I just don't dare write some things. I have to stick to what I know. And that's one thing. That's all I know in the writing field that I'm in. I just don't know anything else because I've tried other things. A guy said to me one time, why don't you write a play? I said, okay. I wrote a play. And then after he read it, he said, good God, we can't do this. And I said, well, why not? What's wrong with it? I like it. And in the first act, the male lead was having an affair with his mother. In the second act, he was having an affair with his father. In the third act, he found out he was adopted and got mad and left home. They wouldn't produce it. I thought it was a funny play. So I have to watch what I hand in sometimes, different people that I work for still. I've had a life instead of what it was before I got here. I don't know what you people gave up to come here, but I didn't give up nothing but a bunch of crap. All those jails, and my God, I was a shit magnet for the cops. I just couldn't go any place. There they are. In Venice in those days, you could get what was known as a kick out the next morning, but you still had to do the night in jail. And of course, they hit you a few times on the head with that goddamn stick. I can still hear it in my brain, that bonk sound that when they hit. So my solution to all that was to drink closer to the jail. That's the kind of thinking that I had. What do you mean, quit? What is that? So after I came here, there was a lot to clean up. A lot. And we have some friends that are writers and actors and actresses and all that. And one of them wrote this some time ago. Man developed language because of a deep inner need to complain, snivel, and whine. And I identify with that. That's a damn good inventory. When I first heard that, I thought, where do I sign? Story of my life in many ways. I've had some great and wonderful times here. I've had some bummer times. It has not been all that easy on some days. I've been a manic, depressive, suicidal, whatever. I've walked out of meetings some nights when I thought, why don't people feel these vibes I'm sending out? They're so strong. Spiritual vibes, that is. And one night I went home and I laid down in the back seat of my car with the motor running, determined I was going to do myself in. I've had it with this world here. I just didn't, and I had a job, I had a nice house, all kinds of things, but I was not happy. And I found out that I had to go to the can, so I'm not going to be found with wet pants, so I go in the house, and while I'm in there, the phone rings. Nosy Parker, I got to answer that goddamn phone, and it turned out to be a newcomer in a depression. He's interrupting my suicide attempt. But I had to tell him how good I felt. But somebody with 17 years sober, you know, you got to look good, right? I had to get over that crap. I had to tell the truth. What it is, is. It's Bill Wilson. No, that wasn't Bill Wilson. It was Bill Clinton, wasn't it? Somebody like that. I don't know. Doesn't matter. Never could tell those two apart. Oh, by the way, I'm up here without a watch. How are we doing on time? It's got to be time to go, isn't it? Oh, that's fine. Okay. Because if you can't say it in 45 minutes, you can't say it. Some of these speakers that drone on and on. God, spare me that. Carrying that spiritual message. Yes. Oh, yeah. My whole group can walk on the water. Yeah, I'll bet. Anyway, come on in here and use this thing. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of talk. I stayed clean and sober long enough to find out that I wanted to live most of the time. And when I didn't want to live, I learned to do something about that. And it has not been easy along the way in some areas, sometimes. And I try to leave you with some hope tonight, since I've been sober 2 years longer than God. Well, he thinks he's God, doesn't he, that guy over there? Anyway. Again, there's room for everybody here, remember that. It's the same set of 12 steps for all of us, and nobody's ahead of anybody else. Some of us got here earlier than others, but that's all that means. I'm still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that I in turn can be an active member of the human race, because it's my species in spite of what I think on some days. I disagree with people that say I've never been to a bad meeting. I think, well, I know one right up the street here that... I've had better flashbacks than some of those goddamn things. I take my program serious, but not somber or deadly. I've had some absolutely wonderful times here. I always thought, well, if that happened to me, it's going to last. And I'm grateful now that it hasn't, because it keeps me coming back. I am nosy. I don't want to miss anything here. See, I've had some great experiences here that you couldn't have had any place else besides that clown getting up here and Blake taking him off the podium that night. I've been to other meetings where some nights the spiritual feeling in the room is so thick you could cut it with a knife, and there's plenty of it for everybody. So get your share and take it with you. And I had a great experience at a club over here a few years ago. There's a little gay dude there that I ride motorcycles, and he said to me, "Give me a ride on your motorcycle, Sam." And I said, "Alexis, leave me alone, please. Just go away. Talk to your sponsor." And after about 2 weeks, I'd had enough, and I said, "All right, Alexis, get on." Put a helmet on him, took him up on the Hollywood Freeway, went 110 miles an hour, came back to the... I thought, well, that'll fix him. He'll wet his pants over that. Got back to the club, and he got off the bike, and I said, "Well, what did you think of that, Alexis?" He said, "Well, I've always wanted to be a motorcycle bitch. I'm yours." Had to explain to him, it's not motorcycle bitch, it's biker bitch. Got that? Well, if I'd stayed home, I'd miss that. Stay home and watch Slip of Vision and get hung up on that. I know people that are hung up on their computers. It's like they're Siamese twins. What is that connected to you? Oh, it's the computer. Yeah, they drag it every place. That and their goddamn cell phones. Does anybody have that much to talk about? Really? So I've had a good time being here tonight, and I hope you have too. Enjoy yourselves as much as you possibly can. Yeah, because those rough times are going to come. I disagree with people that say, "Oh, it gets better and it gets better and it gets better. What it has gotten for me is different. What has gotten better is the ability to cope with the bullshit. That's what has gotten better." And so hang around those that tell you the truth. And cut through your bullshit, because we all got it. And I would not be alive today if it hadn't been for some of those people who literally laid the truth on me when I didn't want to hear it. And so I'm very glad to be in this room tonight where I can communicate with my fellow alcoholics. And the thing's been running through my mind for several days that everything would be a hell of a lot better if the whole world was gay. I don't know where that came from. It just wanders through the way my life is. I think of these wild mixed up things sometimes. Well, why don't we try it? It can't be any worse than the mess these so-called straight mothers are making out of the goddamn world. Jesus Christ. Anyway, enjoy this convention and go to things like this as much as you possibly can and communicate with your fellow alcoholics. There's where the healing process has taken place many, many nights for me when I didn't necessarily want it, but I knew what to do about it. And so I went to meetings and I found somebody and I talked to them. And I don't mean talked very long. Just get it out and get it said and then go on, move on. Because I've lived one hell of a life because I came here and sobered up. The rest of my family, good God, they don't know where they're at or what they're doing. Suicides all over the place. They just have not been able to find this thing. So I consider myself the luckiest human being in the world, or one of the luckiest human beings in the world. I think we all are, that have found this thing and stay around here. Did you notice all the people that stood up tonight that have some time in this room? You're goddamn right to where it's at. You know it can be done. It doesn't, you know, it's not something we've just read out of a book. See, experience is the thing that's of supreme value, not advice. All advice is shit, all of it. I want to hear experiences, and that's what has saved my life on many a day. Again, I'm glad that I could be here and communicate with my fellow alkies. It's been one hell of an evening for me. I'm glad we could get together, and so we can all lurch along the murky road to happy destiny together. I know, for you purists, the book says trudge, but I lurch all over the goddamn. It's murky as all hell on some days. I need a seeing-eye newcomer to get to a meeting.